Prime Minister, dear Lawrence, ministers, members of parliament, ambassadors, generals, ladies and gentlemen, I want first to thank Prime Minister of Singapore for his hospitality and his commitment to the strategic partnership with France. And thank you for offering me this opportunity, and thank you to ISS for the opportunity to address very important forum for security in Asia and beyond. And I have to say, I received the invitation for your predecessor, Lawrence, in 2018. And I have to confess this evening that I'm not sure I was so right to procrastinate. Because for sure, it would have been easier to come in 2019 and deliver a speech on all these topics. Nevertheless, I'm here in front of you, and I will try to share some convictions. And first, let me tell you why I'm so committed to this region and why France has something to tell. First, and it's most of the time forgotten, because France is an Indo-Pacific player. We have overseas territories in the region, from Réunion Island, Mayotte, to Wallis et Futuna, New Caledonia, French Polynesia, and other territories. So more than 1 million inhabitants, French inhabitants, live in this region. We have more than 8,000 soldiers permanently deployed in our bases. We established permanent bases in the region with some partners. And we deployed a lot of common exercises with France during the past few years with a lot of countries, and even recently here with our aircraft carrier. And at the same time, obviously, we are a European country, and I will revert in my remarks several times about this new special relationship we have to consider between Europe and Indo-Pacific, and European Union and ASEAN. Clearly, we are living in a time of multiple crises, and it has to create new incentives to cooperate and perhaps try to invent new forms of cooperation as well. I would like first to try to explain a very important concept to me, starting this discussion, which is the fact that we have to be very careful on double standards for our action. Second, I will try to revert on the common interest in strategic autonomy we have between Europe and Asia, and I will try to share some key pillars of this new partnership between Europe and Asia. But first, allow me to start with the importance of not to accept, I would say, the double standards in the current environment. Indeed, we live in this world of multi-crisis, and the big risk is just to look at the crisis at our border and to forget our principles and to forget the fact that all these crises and these wars are interconnected. And I say that in a country, I have to say, and I want to commend you, Lawrence, and your predecessor, where, for instance, the Ukrainian war was never perceived as a European war. But from the very beginning, you took your responsibility and you were very vocal. But let's be clear, we have several risks of double standards in our current environment. Double standards in Ukraine. For a lot of countries, in LATAM, Africa, Asia, here, I hear the narrative, and most of the time what is shared is a sort of equidistance between Ukraine and Russia, and the fact that this is a European conflict, and that we are clearly spending too much energy, too much time, and creating too much pain for the rest of the world with what's happening in Ukraine. Allow me to say this is a total mistake. Because if we consider that Russia could be allowed to take a part of the territory of Ukraine without any restriction, without any constraint, without any reaction of the global order. How would you phrase what could happen in Taiwan? What will you do the day something happens in Filipinos? There is no several global order by definition. If we stick to our principles, this is true in Europe and this is true elsewhere. So what is at stake in Ukraine is our common credibility to be sure that we are still able to preserve territorial integrity and sovereignty of people. No double standard. At the same time, I hear the voice in this region, as well in Africa, in Latam, the Gulf, about the double standard in Gaza, where a lot of things that the Americans and the Europeans are in fact giving a free pass to Israel. And this is a big risk. This is why we did condemn the terrorist attack from the Hamas. We work very hard with some key partners, and I want to thank them here, to release the hostages. This is the very last one. We do support all the initiatives taken for a ceasefire, and I do thank the efforts made by the United States of America, Egypt, Jordan, Qatar in that direction. But we do believe that we need a ceasefire. The emergency is for a humanitarian answer. And we do have to work very hard for recognition of a Palestinian state and a mutual recognition in order to create a strong architecture of security in the region. And I can revert, if you want, into Q&A on this aspect. But this is the only way not to leave the floor to those saying you live with double standards. If we abandon Gaza, if we consider there is a free pass for Israel, even if we do condemn the terrorist attacks, we kill our own credibility in the rest of the world. And this is why we do reject double standards, and this is why I think it's very important in our current environment to be consistent and to follow our principles, our rules, and to consider that what is at stake is clearly the global order, and what is at stake is our credibility to protect this global order. Having said that, I think a risk of double standards is as well to abandon totally our agenda of sustainability and health. And it could surprise a lot of people when I say that in front of a lot of defense ministers and so on, but everything is intercorrelated. And by the way, we experienced quite recently the fact that the pandemic could have some security impact and change a little bit the course of the world. But this is a double standard. If we, as a rich country, we stop investing in sustainability, meaning climate and biodiversity and health, because this is the new nexus, because it could create new crisis and new security crisis, and because this is a killer for our credibility vis-à-vis the South. This is the best way to open the door for a big divide of this world. So this is why, having said that, I do consider that rejecting double standards in all these affairs do not imply balancing everything, but very clearly requires us to be very consistent in this approach. And I insist on that because I do believe that the main risk today is a risk of division of the world and a division between the two superpowers. And the instruction given to all the others, you have to choose your side. If we do so, we will kill the global order, and we will destroy methodically all the institutions we created after the Second World War in order to preserve peace and to have cooperation on health, on climate, on human rights, and so on. But we need them, probably much more than before. This is why I believe our key challenge is how to preserve peace and stability and prosperity in this current environment. And in a moment when the competition between China and the United States for global leadership could create constraints and a side effect for each of us, without us willing or even able to imagine handing our interests over to one or the other, how to react. And I will be clear. France, is a friend and an ally of the United States. And is a friend, and we do cooperate, even if sometimes we disagree and compete with China. I do intend to remain so, loyally, with a demanding approach of our own interests. But France is no less attached to what is essential for herself, strategic autonomy, freedom of sovereignty. And we do defend this approach for Europe and for Indo-Pacific, which means we want to cooperate, but we don't want to depend. We want to cooperate, but we don't want to be instructed on a daily basis what is allowed, what is not allowed, and how our life will change because of the decision of a single person. And the commitment by France is part of a long-term commitment. It's a singular voice, faithful to a certain idea of peoples and their independence, which General de Gaulle set out in 1966 in his speech in Phnom Penh. And this idea remains a compass of France, and we intend to continue being a force for peace and equilibrium. Having said that, I do believe that Europe and Asia, and this is my second point, have a common interest in this very moment, and a common interest to follow this line of strategic autonomy. First, because we live the same challenges. We have a challenge of revisionist countries that want to impose, under the name of spheres of influence, in reality, spheres of coercion. Countries that want to control areas, from the fringe of Europe to the archipelagos in the South China Sea, at the exclusion of regional partners, oblivious to international law. Countries that want to appropriate resources, whether fishing or mineral, and crowd out others from their benefit. Countries that want to impose on free countries their foreign policy choices or prejudice their alliances. No way for these spheres of coercion. Second, we have the challenge of terror and enduring mutual grievances that remains all too present, and we saw it very recently again in the region. And it is compounded by the alarming propensity of countries to resort to force, including between heavily armed states, as we saw it as well very recently. Third, we live in a time of a potential erosion of long-time alliances, whose credibility and clout is under threat. Alliances, by the element of balance they brought, had been essential to maintain stability in Europe and Asia. And the sense that their promise might not be ironclad is ushering in a new instability. We see it every day. And the credibility of the alliances, which is to be confirmed, is a very important point for stability. Fourth, we have now a big risk of nuclear proliferation. This is why the situation in Iran is so critical, and this is why we do consider that the work which is being done by the United States of America in Iran is so critical. And this is why, especially the E3, wants to be a reliable and consistent partner in order to avoid any type of nuclear proliferation in Iran, because it would trigger all sorts of justification to proliferate elsewhere with a domino effect. But let's be clear, the situation is very challenging as well in Europe. When Ukraine, the country that renounced nuclear weapons in 1991, is the one that Russia is repeatedly invading, how could there not be a second thought? When the DPRK is developing a massive nuclear arsenal unconstrained by China and is now entering an alliance with Russia, a nuclear weapon state, permanent member of the UN Security Council, supposed to act responsibly. How are regional countries threatened by the DPRK supposed to act? What can reasonably be on their mind when they owe their people, before anything else, their security? In Europe and in Asia, how can mid-sized countries faced with aggressive nations ensures that they won't have to surrender or live in fear. But sure enough, our challenges are not only similar, they are getting increasingly intertwined. They are intertwined because when you look at this situation, during the past few years, I had objected to NATO having any role in Asia, because for me, N is for North Atlantic. And because I don't believe in being enrolled in someone else's strategic rivalry. But what's happening with North Korea being present alongside with Russia on the European soil is a big question for all of us. And this is why, if China doesn't want NATO being involved in Southeast Asia or in Asia, they should prevent clearly DPRK to be engaged on the European soil. All this is happening also at a moment when nations like France and Asian countries are facing issues of scale raised by the development of technology, and I clearly make the linkage between these two issues. Our challenges are intertwined because we do face the same reality. Whether we are talking about AI or space, scale is of the essence. And in these two critical dual-use technologies, the first to reach scale will be much more competitive and will drive out the others. And we can't lose the race. And this is why, by the way, we want to team up with Singapore on all these issues, and we have a very strong partnership. But this is how we are clearly linked together in these common challenges. Another race we cannot afford to lose is that of hybrid warfare. With cyber and disinformation, there is a clear attempt to undermine our democracies, our social cohesion, sometimes even our territorial integrity, and all this is done with underlying geopolitical aims. And clearly, this is the same here and in Europe. More generally, as we gear ourselves for future confrontations, we have to make sure that we arm ourselves with the tools of tomorrow's, not yesterday's war. And let's be clear, both ASEAN and Europe are impacted by the unpredictability of the new tariff approach and the end of a rule-based order for our trade. And this is something which will impact our prosperity, our capacity to finance our defense efforts, and something which will request much more cohesion. All these challenges I've just mentioned are the perfect illustration of the fact that we are living in a time where what we have to do is to face these challenges and to take into consideration that both the Europeans and the Asians are much more intertwined than we thought. But the question now is how to act concretely in order to deliver the strategic autonomy agenda. This is a challenge for Europe, this is a challenge for your region, and this is a common challenge. Because this is the only way to preserve freedom, prosperity, and security. Let me start by Europe first. We cannot overestimate the depth of the mental revolution brought about by Russia's aggression and the concerns about alliances. But let's be clear, I have advocated for years more independence, more sovereignty, more strategic autonomy for all Europe. Let's be clear, there was a doubt during a few years. But in March 2022, the European Union decided very clearly a strategic autonomy agenda. And we decided on defense and security, on technology, on industry, on energy, on all the different fields to reduce our dependencies and de-risk our model. It is absolutely critical in the current environment. And during the past few months, based on the work we collated with the British Prime Minister, the coalitions of the willings, and the strong coordination with some leaders, with Chancellor of Germany, Prime Minister of Poland, but a whole bunch of countries of the European Union, and a lot of allies, we built this coalition of the willings regarding the Russian war in Ukraine. And the message was very clear. We will work together to the very end to provide security guarantees to the Ukrainian, to build a robust peace in this region of the world, and to reinvest our own defense and security, because Russia will remain an existential threat for us. This is the second wake-up call after 2022. And what we will do, what we are doing, is to increase till 3.5% GDP our defense expenditure. Probably we will go further and faster. But this is the willingness of the Europeans to build their independence in terms of defense and security, which is consistent with the request and the fair request of the United States of America, which is to say, you should take more of the burden for your own security. We cannot afford any more with all the expenditures for your security. A third of the expenses on the eastern flank of NATO is taken by the US. We need the Europeans to do much more for themselves. But at the same time, we need the Europeans to be much more independent for themselves, meaning building their own capacities and capabilities, developing their own industries, and working by choice with the US, with partners here in the region, but not depending on anybody, especially for our own security. This is our agenda. This is the agenda of strategic autonomy. In parallel, this is what we want on AI, what we want on technology, on industry. We want to increase our strategic autonomy. It will request a lot of investment, and obviously, it will request as well a much more competitive Europe. This is why, and I link this to agenda, it's an emergency to accelerate the competitiveness agenda of the European Union, because this is the only way to make the security agenda and the autonomic strategy agenda credible. Meaning we have to deepen the single market, we have to streamline our regulation, and sometimes to kill some of these regulations to be much more attractive, and we have to accelerate our capacity to build new single market, especially in finance with capital market union, especially to fund what I'm saying with private money, to be much more efficient on energy and telco. Second, we want to build new partnerships. And it's part of the strategic autonomy. And based on the assessment that between ASEAN and Europe, we have these common challenges and these common threats. We want to work more actively on a common agenda. France presented in 2018 an Indo-Pacific strategy based on our capacity to propose a third way, which is to say a lot of you are afraid and concerned by the respect of the liberty of sovereignty. Liberty of navigation, respect of your sovereignty, and so on. For good reasons, we do share this view. But you don't want to be confrontational with China. We do share the same approach. And the third way we do share with a lot of countries present in this room is the basis of our Indo-Pacific strategy, which is how to preserve an open environment, rule-based order, in the region. And we want to be a reliable partner for that. This is the core of the bilateral commitment we have with Singapore, but with a lot of countries of the region, and exactly what we did during the past few years. Common exercises, common capacities, more common programs, etc., etc. De-risking, no confrontation, but clearly strategic autonomy in the Pacific strategy. And we are working on a new strategic review, and a new Indo-PAC strategy will be issued in the weeks to come. And in parallel, we raise at the European scale this approach, because we issued now 4 years ago a European Union's Indo-Pacific strategy, which follows exactly the same line, and which is the best illustration of our common commitment. And very clearly, we want to go further, particularly with India, the Asian countries, and the members as well of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And for me, this new approach is very important, and we discussed yesterday with the Prime Minister and with a lot of countries here. If we team up, we represent a third of global growth, even more in terms of trade. We have a lot of credible players. Some of them have deterrence capacities. Let's work together on this agenda of strategic autonomy. Let's work in an open way, in a genuine way. Let's engage with everybody which is available. But let's work very closely on defense, security, and all the building blocks of our value chains to be sure that we de-risk our model. Let's work to have as well trade cooperation, new trade agreements. Because if between EU and the Trans-Pacific countries, we have such an agreement, it's extremely powerful for the rest of the planet. Third, having spoken about Europe, about the alliance between Europe and this region, what to do together? New coalitions, new agreements, and how to reset a new rule-based order. 70 years ago, the Bandung Conference was for many the opportunity to express their rejection of the logic of blocs and to express their desire to find their own way. The time for non-alignment has undoubtedly passed, but the time for coalitions of action has come and requires that countries capable of acting together give themselves every means to do so. We must show consistency where others practice a double game. And this is exactly my call tonight at the Shangri-La Dialogue. Let's build new coalition for open trade, open dialogue to de-risk our models, stable environment, and new coalitions to stabilize open and rule-based order. The rules must remain the inviolability of borders, respect for sovereignty, refusal to use force as a means of domination, and we must cultivate a spirit of independence and a desire for cooperation. And saying that, I have the feeling almost to quote the DNA and to describe the DNA of Singapore. But this is exactly what we need. With, in fact, the offer to both the US and China to join such an approach. But we cannot just remain seated and say, okay, there is no more WTO. What do we do with the tariffs? Okay, we are not so sure that we have the full-fledged guarantee in the existing alliance. What do we do? We want to act. We want to preserve our stability, our peace, and our prosperity. So let's work together. Let's build a positive new alliance between Europe and Asia based on our common norms, on our common principles. Our shared responsibility is to ensure with others that our countries are not collateral victims of the imbalances linked to the choices made by the superpowers. Our response must be to relaunch our efforts to develop sustainable trade, respectful of common social and environmental standards, and step by step, the European Union is building this network of new generation agreements, and this is what we want to do with ASEAN countries and CPTPP. I do believe indeed that based on such an approach, we can deliver very credible and concrete results. And I really believe that based on such an approach, we can convince the others to join us, given our magnitude and our credibility. This is, for me, the content of the strategic autonomy we have to deploy now in Europe, and we have to cooperate on this basis with your region. I will just conclude now with a plea, a call for action for Europe and Asia to work together on a coalition of independence, a coalition of countries that won't be enrolled but won't be bullied, a coalition of countries that object to the double standard, a coalition of countries that will pool their strengths to ride the race of technology, uphold norms, and protect their sovereignty, a coalition of countries that will navigate the rough seas of trade and protect the global commons of nature and climate. And finally, a coalition of countries determined not to yield to the whims of the greed of others, but to chart a peaceful way, to bring balance in trouble, and to affirm that negative passions can be opposed and indeed superseded by universal values. This is our common DNA, And this is exactly, I do believe, why Singapore does exist, why Eurogen have so many countries being independent today, and why both France and the European Union are here today. Thank you for your attention.
And France's President Emmanuel Macron, that delivering the keynote at the IISS Shangri-La Dialogue 2025 right here in Singapore. He linked several issues together. Crises are connected, therefore the solution to these crises also connected. He said it was important not to see crises as separate. For example, the Ukraine war is not just a European war. If Russia seizes territory without being curbed, then that might happen elsewhere in the world, and he cited Taiwan as an example. It was important to preserve territorial integrity because that means preserving credibility. At stake, he says, is the global order. Now, this is built towards President Macron's. It's been a theme throughout his time in office since 2017, that of strategic autonomy. This, for him, is being independent and not dependent, and yet relying, looking to partners, but not depending on partners for key issues. And he said Europe and Southeast Asia share interests in both being strategically autonomous, because both face similar geoeconomic situations from revisionist countries, he said, threats in trade and crumbling alliances. And the way to address that was to be more intertwined in thought and acting with strategic autonomy.
A single theater.
Let's take a listen to the question and answer session that's taking place at the Shangri-La Dialogue with President Macron.
How do you see France playing a leading role and picking up from what you said earlier regarding multiple crises? Right now in the Indo-Pacific, there is a proliferation of security crises, ongoing challenges from India, Pakistan, Thailand, Cambodia, Myanmar to the South China Sea. How does France also hope to help ASEAN build a more robust regional security response to these particular crises? After all, their ability to address these current security crises is perhaps their preconditions to achieve strategic autonomy. Thank you.
Do you want to collect a few? Yeah. Shall we take two or three, and then okay. And then you take them in a group? Yes. Okay. So I think Frank Gardner. I think I see. Can we get a microphone to Frank, please? Yeah, there we go. Frank.
Merci, Monsieur President. Frank Gardner from BBC, security correspondent. Do you see a military role for Europe in this region when it's got a full-scale war going on its own continent? I mean, Britain is sending an aircraft carrier here when it can't really afford to meet its own defence obligations in Britain.
Thank you very much. And if I can get a microphone here to the front. First row here, please. Microphone. Yeah, coming. Chungmin Lee from Korea. And then maybe we'll take those three.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. President. I have two quick questions, one nuclear on Europe. You have emphasized strategic autonomy throughout your presidency. If European NATO members ask you for nuclear protection, is France willing to provide your force de frappe to your European NATO allies? And number two, we will have a new Korean government in the next couple of days and will be in office on Wednesday. Whoever wins the election, if the new Korean government asks your government for assistance and cooperation on building a South Korean nuclear-powered submarine, will France say oui or no? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's take those three as a bundle, and then we'll return and take a few more, Mr. President.
Thank you. As for the first, by the way, the two first questions were quite close, and with clearly common issues. I would not consider that fixing all the regional crises is a precondition of strategic autonomy, and we have to do both at the same time. And it's true for Europe and it's true for Asia, meaning we have to fix what's happening in Ukraine, but in parallel we have to strengthen our strategic autonomy. And you have to do the same. I think for the regional crisis you mentioned, the role of the European Union and some European countries when they want or are involved in this crisis is first to assist ASEAN and the key regional players to provide their help. This is what we did, for instance, on Myanmar. And we had this discussion this morning with Mr. Prime Minister on Myanmar, but the question now is much more at the Myanmar level, even if all the countries of the region did their best to promote a solution. But you're right that we have a multiplication of crises, and I would add threats. But I would not oppose the capacity of ASEAN to fix these different crises and the necessity to build strategic autonomy. The second remark, referring to your first question, is that we are working with ASEAN regarding the centrality of this organization in the context of our Indo-Pacific strategy with different approaches. First, procurement and capabilities. And we build some very strong partnerships with some key countries of the region, with our Rafale, but as well our submarines and so on. And this cooperation is not just a commercial cooperation, but it's clearly a strategic one involving a series of clear cooperation. Second, we have common exercises. From Pegasus to the exercise we just deployed in the region with aircraft carriers. And so we multiply this exercise with several objectives, share operational culture, improve interoperability, but as well provide strategic signals and some deterrence vis-à-vis some key players. And this is the way we can deliver. As for your question, but this is as well a bridge towards the second question on the military credibility of the Europeans in the region, let's be clear. We will never sell what we cannot deliver. And if the elephant in the room is the day China decides a big operation against the country, will you intervene day one? I would be very cautious today, but everybody will be very cautious today. I think all the countries in this room, wherever they live, and in fact everybody. But let me be clear. I think our role is not to be a substitute to anybody, but our role is to work for ourselves to improve our strategic autonomy, meaning our own capacity to protect our soil, but through the cooperation we have to help the ASEAN countries to do the same for themselves and to reduce on both sides our dependencies. And we have to do it in a time where there is an increase of the threats and the strategic risks. So which means this is a very important step. I don't underestimate it. But as for the credibility of the Europeans, and perhaps more broadly, I would be very honest with you. If both the United States of America and the Europeans are unable to fix on the short run the Ukrainian situation, I think the credibility of both the US and the Europeans to pretend to fix any crisis in these regions will be very low. Let's be honest. Because till now, all of us said what happened in Ukraine is a clear violation of international law. What happened in Ukraine is unacceptable. Everything we describe for all the regional threats, not to mention them, linked to China. And we are ready to help, to finance, to provide capabilities, but we are till now ready to sacrifice till the very last Ukrainian soldiers. Full stop. So I think our credibility is at stake in this point, and this is why everything is intercorrelated. As for, and thank you for the very two accurate question. For the first one, I will obviously not provide such an answer, but I will tell you why. Because the credibility of the nuclear deterrence is based on the ambiguity. And I know it's very hard to understand sometimes, but it's very important to stick to this principle. And this is probably one of the weaknesses we have when you are democracies vis-à-vis some authoritarian regime. And this is probably a mistake we made at the very beginning of the conflict in Ukraine when we disclosed too many constraints vis-à-vis the opponents. And this is why, more than 1 year ago, in February 2024, in Paris, I request for restoring strategic ambiguity and stop excluding so many options from the European side. And I'm very happy about the very recent declarations made by the German Chancellor, which exactly did the same very recently. We need strategic ambiguity. The day you give, by the way, all the roadmap to your enemy, you reduce the efficiency of your deterrence capacity. But what I can say is that from the very beginning of the nuclear capacities in France, we integrated a European dimension. And we remain quite large and vague for good reasons. But in parallel, we are working hard and we will launch a new phase, a new era, and I will revert in the months to come on that, in order to have, perhaps with some European countries, a different approach. As for South Korea, I think this is a very fair question, and this question is very legitimate. If I were South Korean, it would be my first question, which is, in fact, if guys, you fail to contain the capacity of North Korea to get nuclear weapon, am I sure that I'm still safe? And am I sure the day I will be attacked, you will not fail to protect me? I think we should reopen the North Korean topic first. I think the big risk of the current environment is to open a new proliferation area. And this is why, for me, Iran is so critical. Because the day, de facto, we accept that, you will trigger a series of legitimate requests of a lot of other countries to get nuclear weapons. So this is why the US agenda on North Korea is so important. And because I will be clear, the Europeans don't have the capacity to be the one to negotiate and trigger such a negotiation. This is clearly the United States of America. And President Trump, during his first mandate, started to resume some discussions. And this is part of the strategic discussion we have to frame with the United States, because it's a fair approach to say we want to deliver less for the Europeans, and the Europeans have to take much more of their burden because we want to focus on some other issues. But my fair answer would be, I would prefer us collectively to contain much more the capacities and give you visibility on the North Korean capacities and helping you to get access to new ones.
Mr. President, thank you very much.